Sarah's shirt was off. She stood with her arms out while Faith taped a small microphone to her bare chest. They were in the GBI's crime scene investigation bus. The monitors on the wall showed a live image of the closed back doors. The camera was concealed inside Sarah's purse. The tiny hole piercing the leather was no larger than the circumference of her pinky finger. Faith tore another piece of tape off the roll. Sarah looked up at the ceiling. She had to keep her eyes dry. But thinking about what she had missed, what had been right in front of her 8 years ago, made her feel like she was tumbling inside of an avalanche. The latex in Shay Van Dorn's teeth had set off the first tremor. Sarah had been mentally walking herself through the sequence. The latex had not been in the teeth before Shay was embalmed, yet it was there afterward, when Tommy Humphrey had called. The second tremor was caused by a familiar phrase. Tommy's attacker claimed he had been forced to abduct her because she was too stuck up to give him the time of day. Stuck up. Sarah could recall Brock staring longingly at the cheerleaders as they walked to the popular table in the cafeteria.
"They won't even look at me," Brock had whispered. "They're too stuck up to give me the time of day."
The third tremor was the sobbing. Sarah did not know Darryl Nesbitt personally, but she could not imagine him crying over any of his crimes. The only man she had ever met who routinely broke down was the same man who had sat beside her on a school bus for 10 years. The fourth and final tremor had brought down the sky. Brock's mother had been admitted to the hospital the last week of October. Sarah could not recall all of the details, but she could still remember how different Brock had been when he'd come to relieve her in the middle of the night. His overly obsequious manner was gone. He'd been animated, practically giddy. Sarah had chalked it up to anxiety about his mother. In retrospect, she could see his behavior for what it was. Triumph.
"Almost finished."
Faith stood behind Sarah, clipping the transceiver for the microphone to the back of her pants. Dan Brock had spent 2 years earning his associate degree in mortuary sciences. The classes were intense, demanding an intimate understanding of thanatology, chemistry, and human anatomy. As the county coroner, he had been mandated to attend 40 hours of training at the Georgia Public Safety Training Center in Forsyth. There he had learned about forensics and crime scene investigation. Every year, he'd been required to undergo 24 hours of additional in-service training so that he was up to date on any advances in death investigation sciences. He would know how to paralyze a person. He would know how to cover his tracks. Beneath the rubble of the avalanche, Sarah had located the final, most damning clue. She had texted Brock's photo to Tommy Humphrey asking, "Is this him?" After 4 unbearable minutes, Tommy had texted back, "Yes."
"Okay," Faith said. "You can put your shirt back on."
Sarah buttoned her shirt. Her fingers felt thick. She thought about Faith's math equation during yesterday morning's briefing. A plus B equals C. The man who had attacked and mutilated Tommy Humphrey was the same man who had attacked Rebecca Catarino and Leslie Truong. He was the same man who had murdered the women on Miranda Newberry's spreadsheet. He was the same man who had abducted, drugged, and raped Callie Zanger. He was the same man that Sarah had called her friend. Tears flooded her eyes. She was angry. She was terrified. She was devastated. For over 3 decades, Sarah had felt such warmth and true affection for Dan Brock. How could the little boy who'd sat beside her in kindergarten, the gawky teenager who'd been so self-deprecatingly funny, be the monster who had tortured, raped, and killed so many women?
"Go ahead." Faith was holding one side of the headphones to her ear. Sarah tried to keep her voice as normal sounding as possible.
1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
Good.
Faith rested the headphones on the table.
Are you sure you want to do this?
No, Sarah admitted.
But we don't have bodies or crime scenes. We have guesses and a spreadsheet.
The families deserve answers, and this is the only way to get them.
We could roll the dice, Faith said. Arrest him, scare the shit out of him. He could still talk.
Sarah knew that would never happen.
Once it's out there in public, he will do everything he can to deny it. The Van Dorns, Callie Zanger, Gerald Catarino, all of the victims he left behind. They will never know the truth.
Brock won't go on the record, especially while his mother is still alive. Faith looked grim. She opened the door. Will was standing vigil outside. He was wearing a Kevlar vest. His rifle was slung over his shoulder. Menace came off his body like sweat. He looked at Sarah, silent, but the silence said everything. Sarah pulled on her blue cardigan with the deep pockets. Amanda climbed into the van, telling Sarah,
"The code word is salad."
Sarah looked back at Will. He shook his head. He did not want her to do this. Amanda continued,
"The moment you want to shut it down, for any reason, just say the word and we'll come running, yes?"
Sarah cleared her throat.
"Yes."
Faith studied the monitors.
They were half a mile down the road from the all-care facility.
The camera on the dashboard of Nick's car showed them the front of the warehouse. There were no cameras inside because of privacy concerns.
Amanda coached, "A full confession to all of the murders would be glorious, but any specifics you can get out of Brock about Catarino or Truong will be enough to stick a needle in his arm."
She meant the death penalty.
Amanda said, "I've got men outside the loading dock and around the back, but we can't go in. We don't know if the window shutters inside Brock's office are still closed. Once you're in the warehouse, Will and Faith will stage in the corridor. That's the closest anyone can get without risking exposure. Everything the camera and mic pick up will stream to their phones. If you say the code word, count on it taking them roughly 8 to 10 seconds to breach the office door."
Sarah nodded. Her body had gone numb.
"Here."
Faith held out a loaded revolver, the muzzle pointing down.
"If you need to use this, keep pulling the trigger until the cylinder is empty, okay? 6 shots. Don't hesitate. Don't shoot to wound. Shoot to stop."
Sarah weighed the revolver in her hand. She glanced at Will. She tucked the gun into one of the deep pockets of her cardigan.
"Nick?"
Amanda spoke into the radio.
"Report."
"The target is still inside."
Nick's voice scratched through the speaker.
"Lunch shift cleared out the building. We snagged them once they hit the street. I hooked the manager and had a sit-down talk. They don't start back up taking deliveries until 1. We've got the street blocked off at both ends. There's 9 cars left in the parking lot. 1 belongs to Brock. The others are registered to employees. The manager says they're probably in the break room."
Amanda said,
"Faith, job 1 is getting those civilians out without alerting Brock."
"The break room has a window that overlooks the warehouse," Faith said.
She had found the blueprints for the building on the county website.
"We'll have to be careful."
"Every second of this operation should be careful."
Amanda turned to Sarah.
"Your call, Dr. Linton. We can take him down right now. Tommy can identify him. She would be a compelling witness. We can build a case without a confession."
Shay Van Dorn, Alexandra McAllister, Rebecca Catarino, Leslie Truong, Callie Zanger, Pia Dansky, Teresa Singer, Alice Scott, Joan Feeney. Sarah slipped the purse strap over her shoulder.
"I'm ready."
Will helped her down from the van. She held onto his hand. She kissed him on the mouth.
She told him, "We'll get McDonald's for dinner." He wouldn't let her lighten the mood.
"If he touches you, I will kill him."
Sarah squeezed his fingers before letting go. The farther she walked away from Will, the more numb she felt. A sort of anesthesia spread from her limbs into her chest, so that by the time Sarah made it to her car, her movements were robotic. She put on her seatbelt, started the engine, selected the gear, pulled onto the road. Will and Faith trailed behind her in a black sedan. Sarah could see the resigned set to Will's jaw in her rearview mirror. The half-mile drive to the warehouse stretched out endlessly, her mind filled with everything and nothing at the same time. Should she do this? Could she do this? What if Brock didn't talk? What if he got angry? She had told everyone that Brock would never hurt her, that he could have done that long ago if he wanted. But what if the Brock that Sarah knew turned into the Brock who took pleasure in the suffering of women? She had seen firsthand evidence of his madness. He hadn't been content to rape the women. He had destroyed them. Sarah was about to push him to the brink. Would he try to destroy her, too? She tapped down the blinker. She made the turn. The all-care warehouse looked the same as it had the day before, except where it didn't. SWAT was already on the roof of the building. A glimpse across the street told her that a sniper was covering the front entrance. Sarah knew that another sniper would be guarding the rear. Two more black-clad men were on either side of the concrete stairs to the lobby. If all went as planned, Brock would be waiting for her inside of his cluttered office. Sarah had called to tell him that she would drop off the key to his storage unit. Brock had sounded delighted that he would get to see her again. He would be eating lunch at his desk. He'd offered to share some cake that he'd brought from home. Mama's recipe. Sarah coasted into a parking space by the front door. She should take a moment to breathe, to calm her pounding heart. But the exercise would be futile. Nothing could calm her. She adjusted the purse on her right shoulder as she got out of the car, her left hand tucked into the pocket of the cardigan. She held onto the gun so that it wouldn't bump against her hip as she walked toward the entrance. Two men with rifles were on either side of the concrete stoop. Their backs were to the wall. Their eyes tracked Sarah as she climbed the stairs. Behind her, a car engine turned off. Doors were opened and closed. Sarah did not turn to find Will again, but she knew what he was doing as he followed her from a distance. Her lover was an inveterate list maker. He would be mentally cataloging all of the possible outcomes. 1. Brock confesses and gives himself up. 2. Brock confesses and doesn't give himself up. 3. Brock takes Sarah hostage. 4. Will shoots Brock. Sarah added her own addendum. 5. Brock explains how this is all a terrible misunderstanding. Inside the empty lobby, Sarah adjusted her purse so the camera pointed straight on. The receptionist had put an out-to-lunch sign on the counter. A plastic clock with adjustable hands read 1 p.m., indicating the time of her return. Sarah drew in a shallow breath. She gripped the strap of her purse. She tightened her hand around the revolver. She felt lightheaded as she walked down the corridor. She heard Will and Faith enter the lobby. Sarah desperately wanted to turn around, but she wasn't sure she could keep moving forward if she saw Will again. 8 to 10 seconds. That was how long Amanda estimated it would take to breach Brock's office. Sarah doubted it would take Will more than 3. The door to the warehouse was 5 steps away. A bead of sweat rolled down her chest. She could feel it slip past the concealed mic, pool into her bra. She glanced at the photographs on the wall. David Harper, Employee of the Month. Hal Watson, Facility Manager. Dan Brock, Director of Embalming Services. A map of the state was taped beside Brock's photo. Shaded blue areas indicated all Kara's territory. This was a newer version than the map in Brock's office. White County was solid blue. My stomping ground. Sarah heard the chatter of low voices. She turned around. Faith was clearing the employees out of the break room. Will had his hand on his rifle, finger resting along the trigger guard. Their eyes met one last time. Sarah took a deep breath. She opened the door and walked into the warehouse. Her senses were overloaded. The smell of formaldehyde, the harsh overhead lights that sharpened every corner of the room. The 30 stainless steel tables were empty but for one. An embalmer had washed the hair of the deceased woman at her station. Her hand stroked back and forth as she combed out the tangles. Sarah checked that the wooden shutters on Brock's office windows were closed. She cleared her throat. She told the woman, "Hal asked if you could come to his office for a second."
"Hal?"
the woman repeated, surprised.
"I just need to..."
Sarah checked the shutters again. "Go." The woman's eyes went to the break room window, then back to Sarah. She put down the comb, removed her gloves. She untied her apron as she quickly walked away. Sarah felt her heart beat triple as she neared Brock's office. Her hands had started to shake. Years of practice as a doctor, a surgeon, and a medical examiner had given her the ability to mute her emotions. Standing outside Brock's closed office door, she found herself unable to flip the switch. He was one of her oldest friends. He was a rapist. He was a murderer. Sarah knocked on his door.
"Sarah? Is that you?"
The door swung open. Brock was smiling his same old smile. He went to hug her, but she backed away. Sorry. Sarah panicked over the stutter. She had planned this part. She had known he would try to hug her because they always hugged.
"I'm getting a cold. I don't want you to catch it."
"I've got the constitution of a goat after working in this place."
He waved her in.
"I'm sorry I couldn't go to lunch. I had to prepare for a meeting."
Sarah's left hand stayed in her pocket. The revolver was coated in her sweat. She forced her legs to move. She looked around, expecting everything to look the same as it had the day before. Nothing was the same. Brock had cleaned his office. He must have worked through the night. The overflowing files had been tidied away. The forms and purchase orders were neatly stacked in labeled trays. His desktop was clean, but for two large ring binders. Each one was at least 3 inches thick. The vinyl covers were dark green. She could see the All Care logos embossed in gold on the front. She tried not to look nervous as she glanced at the closed slats on the wooden shutters. They could not see out. No one could see in.
"Sorry it's so warm in here."
Brock had unbuttoned the cuffs of his dress shirt. He was rolling up his sleeves.
"Do you want some water or something to drink?"
"No, thank you."
Sarah worked to keep the tremble out of her voice.
"You straightened up."
"I was so ashamed yesterday after you left. I don't usually let things get that bad."
He motioned toward the small table.
"Have a seat. Can you stay a while?"
Sarah placed her purse on the table, making sure the camera was pointed toward the other chair. She sat all the way back, putting as much space as she could between them. Brock said,
"Maybe I shouldn't risk getting your cold."
Instead of taking the chair across from her, Brock went behind his desk and sat down. The thick binders were in front of him. Sarah could see his hands resting on the desk, but the camera could not. The hole in her purse was too low. Will would be anxious. He would want to see Brock's hands at all times. She prayed that he would not come crashing through the door. Brock asked. Did you get the number you were looking for? She felt her eyebrows go up.
For Delilah? Brock said. I asked Mama, but you know how forgetful she can be, bless her heart.
Sarah felt a quiver in her bottom lip. This was too normal. She couldn't let this be normal.
Sarah?
Yes. She had to push out the words. I found her.
That's good, he said. How'd Lucas and them treat you in Villa Rica this morning?
She felt the surprise spread across her face. Lucas had assisted her with the exhumation of Shay Van Dorn. He said,
Lucas uses all care for his embalming.
Her lip would not stop quivering. She could not maintain this charade. There was latex.
He waited.
Her teeth, Sarah stuttered again. I found latex stuck in Shay's teeth.
Brock's face was expressionless.
From a condom, she said. Post-mortem. His face did not change. He straightened the green binders, making sure they were parallel to the edge of the desk.
You want to hear something funny, Sarah?
She felt her stomach drop. She had pushed him too fast, too soon. She tried.
Brock, after you left yesterday, I was thinking about the first time I realized you were my friend. I bet you didn't even notice when it happened, did you?
Sarah couldn't do this. Dan, please.
You were always so kind to me. You were the only one who was ever kind.
His voice had taken on a wistful tone.
I remember thinking, well, that Sarah Linton is kind to everybody, and I was an everybody, so that's why I was included. But then, one day, you stood up for me. Do you remember what you did?
She had to bite her lip to stop the quiver. What was he doing? She had told him about the latex. Ezra Engel had probably shared the details of Alexandra McAllister's exam. Brock had read the text about Tommy Humphrey that Sarah had accidentally sent to him instead of her mother.
We were in sixth grade.
Brock held up his hands, wagged his fingers.
Coach Childers.
Sarah felt a distant memory creep into her consciousness. Childers had been a farmer. He'd supplemented his income at the school.
He got caught in a combine.
That's right. The rollers on the corn picker pulled him in. Sheared off all his fingers on one hand. Ripped his other arm clean off, he said. Poor fella bled to death before anybody could save him.
Sarah shook her head. What was the point of this? Why was he telling her this story?
I remember when Daddy wheeled Coach Childers into the basement. I wasn't allowed down there on my own, but I just had to see.
Brock chuckled, as if he was relaying a youthful indiscretion.
I waited until everybody was asleep. Then I went down there and unzipped the bag. Coach Childers was lying there on his back. His arm was in a plastic bag on his chest. I guess they couldn't locate the fingers.
Sarah remembered now. The day after Coach Childers had died, Brock had gotten onto the bus to a chorus of taunting children. They all knew the details of the accident. They knew where Coach Childers' body had been taken. She said,
Dead man's hands.
Brock's smile had no joy in it.
That's right. That's what they kept saying. Dead man's hands. Dead man's hands.
He waved his hands the same way the children had. Brock had suffered through their malicious teasing for weeks. He asked,
Do you remember what you did?
She tried to swallow. There was no spit left in her mouth. I yelled at them.
You didn't just yell at them. You stood up in the middle of that bus and you howled at all of them to shut the fuck up.
Brock laughed, as if he was still amazed.
I don't think any of us had ever heard that word out loud before. Hell, most of us didn't even know what it meant. My mama, she said, oh, that Eddie Linton is a potty mouth cursing around them girls. But do you remember what happened next?
This felt so normal. How could it feel normal? She said, I got detention.
You'd never been in trouble a day in your life.
His smile faltered.
You did that for me, Sarah. That's when I knew you were my friend.
She pressed together her lips. The room felt hot. Sweat was pouring down her back. She didn't know what to do. What to say? She begged. Please.
Oh, Sarah, I know this is hard.
Brock clasped together his hands on the desk.
I'm sorry.
His voice was so familiar, so compassionate. She had heard him use the same comforting tone with countless mourners. She recalled it from her own experience the day she had gone to the funeral home to make arrangements for Jeffrey. Brock said,
I took Coach's arm into the woods with me.
Sarah concentrated on the anxiousness in his eyes. He had always been terrified of rejection. She tried to force off the switch in her head, to blunt her emotions.
I was so lonely.
He was watching her, trying to test how far he could go.
I just wanted someone to be with. That's all it ever was for me, Sarah. I wanted somebody who couldn't laugh at me or push me away.
Her hand had gone to her mouth. Her mind refused to understand what he was saying. He said,
It took me a while to figure out that blood is a lubricant.
Vomit churned into Sarah's throat. She swallowed it back down, trying to steel herself. She could not recoil from him. She had to keep him talking. This was for the families. This was for the victims they did not know about.
You make a puncture here.
Brock rubbed his fingers across his chest.
Then you press down, and blood fills the mouth.
Her throat tensed. He was making it sound almost gentle, but Shay Van Dorn's jaw had been dislocated. The condom had ripped against her teeth. Tommy Humphrey had been mutilated. Alexandra McAllister had been scraped out with a knitting needle. Sarah forced the images to leave her mind. She made herself meet Brock's needy gaze. He was waiting for her permission to continue. She could not trust herself to speak, so she nodded. She said,
The first time was with Hannah Nesbitt.
She felt her throat constrict.
I was home from college. Daryl was a kid, maybe 10 or 11, when his mama died. You can look it up, right?
He was expecting an answer. She knew that Daryl Nesbitt's mother had OD'd when he was 8 years old, but she told him, Yes.
The family asked for an open casket. I was in the viewing room making sure everything looked right. And then I got this urge that I had to kiss her one last time.
One last time?
It was very chaste. Just touching my lips to hers.
He held his breath a moment before letting it go.
I turned around, and there was Daryl, standing there, watching. Neither one of us said anything, but there was this silent communication between us. We were two lonely people who knew that something deep down inside of us was wrong.
Sarah struggled to keep her silence. She had been inside of that room. She could visualize the sickening scene in her head. Daryl was a child when he'd walked in on a grown man desecrating his mother's corpse. He'd probably been too frightened, too confused, to make sense of it.
I just knew he was gonna tell.
Brock couldn't look at her anymore. He stared down at his desk.
I waited for him to run off and blab, but he didn't. He kept the secret. So I had to keep his.
Brock sniffed.
He wiped his nose on the back of his hand.
Daddy did 10 or 12 services a year for a Nesbit or an Abbott or some doolally who'd married in.
He told Sarah,
Daryl was always around the young girls, even his own cousins. He would rub up against them, play with their hair. Sometimes he would take them into the bathroom, and they would come out crying.
Brock's eyes were wet with tears.
I'd get so angry, because I knew I couldn't report him. Daryl would tell on me, and Daddy and Mama would hear about it, and that would be the end of my life.
He looked at Sarah.
I could never do that to Mama. You understand what I'm saying? She can never know.
Sarah nodded, but not in agreement. Her emotional switch had flipped off once he'd confessed to bringing a child into his sick confidence. She slipped her hand back into the pocket of her cardigan. The revolver was sticky from her sweat.
A lot of people, when they drink, they do awful things. Then they sober up and they say it wasn't me, it was the booze.
He looked down at his desk.
But I always wondered, what if the person they are when they're drunk is who they really are? What if the person who's sober is the one who's really putting on an act?
Sarah had discerned a pattern. He would wander off topic, then drop in a detail that he knew would keep her listening. She did not have to wait long for him to circle back around.
Axel, Daryl's stepdaddy, he did work for us,
Brock explained.
Sometimes you get a metal casket in, and there's a crushed corner or a ding. Insurance pays for it, but you can still sell it if you can find somebody to fix the damage. Somebody who knows how to work with metal.
Sarah said, the dead blow kit.
Axel left the hammer in one of the caskets.
Brock's weak smile had returned.
I don't know why I kept it. I liked the weight of it. The end was pointed. I found it useful.
Brock had stopped looking at her again. He picked at the corner of one of the green binders. The noise made a ticking sound. She said, you left the hammer inside Leslie. You knew it could be traced by the manufacturing number on the handle.
I planned on saying something when you pulled it out, like, oh, I've seen that thing before. But I didn't know Axel was in prison,
Brock said.
Jeffrey told Frank something while we were all walking to the crime scene. Do you remember that day in the woods?
Sarah remembered the video. The blood that had poured from between Leslie's legs. The splintered hammer, jutting out like broken shards of glass. Brock said,
I heard Jeffrey ask Frank about Daryl. The idea was already in his head. I knew Daryl had access to Axel's tools, because sometimes Axel would bring Daryl to the house to help fix a casket.
Sarah wanted his confession clear for the recording. You left the hammer inside Leslie Truong in order to frame Axel Abbott? Brock responded with a slight tilt of his head, which wasn't enough. She said, the hammer was jammed so deep inside of Leslie that I had to cut it out. Brock wiped his mouth with his fingers. For the very first time, he expressed regret.
I got carried away. I had to work fast. She was almost at the campus when I caught up with her. There wasn't a lot of time to think it through.
He hadn't been thinking at all. He had been acting on his darkest, most heinous instincts. Leslie Truong had not been one of his fantasies. She had been an impediment to Brock acting out his sick desires. She asked, did you take something from Leslie? Were you stalking her?
I didn't know her before that day.
The randomness did not make the violation feel any less grievous.
Sarah, you have to understand. There was no time to plan. She was walking back to the campus. I knew that she had seen me in the woods. If you hadn't been there, I was gonna have to come up with a lie to tell Jeffrey so I could find her.
Sarah remembered finding Brock leaning against a tree, sobbing about the recent loss of his father. At least that's what she had assumed at the time. Now she wondered if he was crying because he was terrified that he would get caught. Brock said,
I had to take advantage of the opportunity. There was only a small amount of time to take care of her. And you're right about the hammer. I knew the number on the handle would help Jeffrey put together the pieces. That's why I left it. But I thought it was Axel who would get in trouble. And it ended up being Daryl. Everything lined up so perfectly, Sarah. It was like God meant it to be.
It was more like dumb luck. Don't bring God into this.
I stopped a pedophile from hurting more children, Brock said. You know about that shed, Sarah. Daryl was planning to take a child. He had everything ready to go. I stopped that from happening. I helped put a baby raper in prison.
She bit her tongue, so she wouldn't tell him that they were both rapists. Brock picked up on her reaction anyway. His eyes would no longer meet Sarah's. He started picking at the corner of the binder again. Tick, tick, tick.
Mama had that asthma attack the October before Daddy died, he said. That's what you want to know about, right?
Sarah's heart lurched into her throat. Yes.
I needed comfort, Brock said.
The same thing he had told Tommy Humphrey 9 years ago.
I didn't plan on doing what I did, but I'd been watching her for so long. And the urge inside of me got so intense. And the next thing I knew, we were in the woods together.
Sarah knew this was a lie. He'd been prepared when he'd abducted Tommy. He'd brought the spiked Gatorade. He'd dipped the washcloth in bleach. He pressed a knitting needle against her neck. He had mutilated her so badly that she could not have children. The sadistic freak hadn't been looking for comfort. He'd wanted to create his own macabre version of a silent wife. Say her name, Sarah told him. She wasn't asking for the recording. She was asking for herself, for Tommy, for all the women he had destroyed. Say her name. He wouldn't do it. Brock said.
That was in October. Then in March, that's when Daddy died.
March. Rebecca Catarino. Leslie Truong. He asked,
Do you remember Johanna Mattis? I think you took care of her kids at the clinic.
He was teetering back on the far end of the circle. Sarah tried to push him along. She died in a car accident.
I was with her when Daddy came down the basement stairs.
Brock's voice took on a heaviness.
I was inside of her mouth, and Daddy walked in on us.
Sarah's hand went to her throat.
Daddy just dropped. He didn't even clutch his arm. I thought he'd fallen down the stairs. The heart attack wasn't what killed him. He was seeing me.
Brock opened his desk drawer. He took out a pack of tissues. He wiped his eyes.
I was so ashamed. But I felt this freedom, too. I didn't have to hide it anymore or sneak around. Mama never went into the basement. I could do what I wanted, but...
His voice trailed off.
I messed up so bad the first time. Nothing happened the way I thought it would. I didn't know the right dosage on the Rehypnol. She kept waking up and moving around. I couldn't get what I needed out of her. Do you get what I'm saying, Sarah? I needed her to be still.
Sarah had seen exactly what he had done. You mutilated Tommy.
She was so dry, and I needed...
His voice dropped to a whisper.
I know I got carried away. The hammer kept catching,
and I didn't realize how sharp the knitting needle was, and I was used to the blood being cold. She was so warm, like a hand wrapping around me. I kept wanting more. It felt so good to be with someone who was a living, breathing thing.
Angry tears burned Sarah's eyes. Tommy was not a thing.
She tried her best to keep still, but she kept twitching, Brock said. That's why I had to use the awl on Becky, to make it so she couldn't move.
Sarah was able to take her first deep breath. There was his confession. He had finally spoken a name. Brock said,
The awl only paralyzed the lower extremities. I figured out how to fix that through trial and error.
Sarah could only think about all of the victims who represented those trials and errors.
With Becky, she kept swinging her little fists. She couldn't keep the Gatorade down. I had to hit her to make her stop. But here's the thing.
Sarah sat back as he leaned forward.
Becky got away, didn't she?
He held up his palm, indicating that Sarah wasn't meant to answer.
I gave them a chance. I left them alone. All of them at some point, they had the opportunity to leave me.
Sarah shook her head at the lie. He hadn't given them a chance. He had drugged them until the drugs stopped working, and then he had used the awl to paralyze them. Some of them, so very few of them, had been lucky enough to take advantage of the narrow window of time in between. Brock said,
When I would go visit them in the woods and see that they were still there, it was just magical.
There was something overtly sexual in the way he lightly traced his finger along his lips.
The ones who stayed with me, I would take my time with them. I brushed their hair, fixed their makeup. It wasn't always about making love. Sometimes I would hold their hands. And when they were gone, I let the animals have them. That's the natural order of things, isn't it? Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
He was referencing their conversation from yesterday morning. Sarah wasn't going to let him justify his delusions. They all ended up back here, didn't they? I saw the map in the corridor. All the counties where you left the bodies are counties that you serve. That's how Shay Van Dorn got the condom stuck in her teeth. You raped her again when she was brought here.
Brock opened another desk drawer. He reached inside.
Sarah tensed, but then she saw what he was doing. Brock laid a pink scrunchie on top of one of the binders. The elastic band was sprinkled with white cartoon daisies. His hand disappeared again. He pulled out a plastic barrette, a pink headband, a red Chanel hair tie, a silver hairbrush, a plastic comb, a tortoiseshell hair clip with one of the teeth missing. Sarah lost count of the number of ties and bands until Brock retrieved the last of his trophies, a long piece of white ribbon. Sarah didn't need to read the orange and blue letters to recognize the Hartsdale High School logo. Is that?
I would never hurt you, Sarah.
Heat rushed through her body. High school. Tennis team. Sarah remembered tying up her hair with a ribbon exactly like the one that dangled between his fingers. She struggled to ask, You took that from me?
Yes, but only so you wouldn't use it anymore.
He carefully laid the ribbon across both the binders.
That's how they got my attention. A flick of the hair, running their fingers through their curls. They'd be in the store or at the gym and just reach up, and it was those private moments that always pulled me in. It was special, only something that I would see. I would watch a light spread around them,
not like a spotlight, but a glow that came from within.
Sarah felt tears on her cheeks. She remembered the hair tie now. She had borrowed it from Tessa. Then she had lost it. Then there had been a screaming argument with slamming doors, and Kathy had finally sent them both to their rooms.
Brock said, Gina Vogel.
The name echoed inside of Sarah's head. She could not take her eyes off the ribbon.
I saw Gina at the grocery a few months ago. She's very funny. You'd like her.
What? Sarah could only see herself at the store, Brock watching her from afar as she untied the white ribbon from her hair.
Sarah?
He waited for her to look up.
I was saving Gina for March, but I had to move things along. I knew that I wouldn't fool you a second time.
Sarah felt the knowledge of what he was trying to say come down around her like another avalanche. The thing they had all feared the most was coming true. She said, You abducted another woman?
Gina is my insurance policy.
Sarah looked around his office with a new understanding. He had known that it was going to come down to this. The boxes were carefully labeled. All of the paperwork was filed. This was the office of a man who had decided to put all of his affairs in order. She said, You want to trade Gina for what? You're not walking out of here, Brock. There's no way.
You'll take care of Mama for me, won't you?
Sarah moved to the edge of her chair. She could see over the green binders. Brock wasn't planning on walking out of here. He had placed a syringe out of view of the camera. The liquid inside was dirty brown. The plunger was pulled back as far as it would go. She shook her head. No.
I can tell you where Gina is.
Brock.
You're such a kind person, Sarah. That's why you're here. Don't you want to give the families closure?
She watched his eyes go to her purse. He had known that he was being recorded.
Gina is still salvageable,
he added,
if you find her in time.
Sarah frantically searched for a way to stop him. He was going to inject himself. What could she do? Take the revolver out of her pocket and threaten him? Shoot him? Say the code word and hope that Will killed Brock before he killed himself? Gina Vogel. Still salvageable.
You're a smart woman, Sarah. You'll put the pieces together.
His eyes flicked down to the binders. He was telling her what was inside.
I don't want a trial.
Tell me where Gina is, Sarah pleaded. We can stop this right now. His hands moved methodically behind the binder.
He uncapped the syringe,
pushed the air out of the plastic barrel.
You know they'll put me to death. Maybe I deserve it. I didn't really give those women a choice. I'm not so far gone that I can't see that.
Please, she begged.
I want to thank you for your friendship, Sarah. I really mean it.
Dan, we can work something out. Just tell me where she is.
Wallace Road intersects at 515, about a mile south of Elijah.
Please. The needle slid into his vein. He rested his thumb on the plunger.
Gina is 2 miles west, about 50 yards from the fire road. I always did like a fire road.
Sarah said the last word that he would ever hear.
Salad!
Brock looked confused, but his thumb was already pressing down the plunger. The brown liquid shot into his vein. His mouth dropped open. His pupils constricted.
Oh!
He gasped, surprised by the rush. By the time Will busted down the door, Brock was dead.
Chapter 29 Gina felt something wet hitting her face. She thought a dog was pissing on her. Then she thought she was in the shower. Then she remembered that she was in the woods. Her eyes opened. The trees swayed overhead. Dark clouds. Still daylight. A drop of rain tapped against her eyeball. Her eyes were open. She blinked. Then she blinked again to prove that she could do it. She was controlling her eyes. She was looking up, seeing things. It was daylight. She was alone. He wasn't here. She had to leave. Gina thought about the muscles in her stomach. The abs. The six-pack. The eight-pack. What was wrong with her? Why did her only knowledge of stomach muscles come from Jersey Shore? For fuck's sakes. He was going to come back. He had told her that he would be back. She clenched her muscles. All of them. Every single streaky slab in her body. She opened her mouth. She screamed as loud as she could, as long as she could, one single word.
Go!
Her body flopped onto its side. She had no idea how she had managed to turn, but she had managed to turn, so she could probably manage other things. But she was so tired and so dizzy that the world flipped upside down. Vomit spewed up her throat. The pain from clenching her stomach was a razor inside her body. She couldn't stop vomiting. The smell made her feel sicker. Her face was in it. She sniffed it up her nose. It was blue, with specks of black. She was vomiting blue. A moan came out of her throat. She sniffed. The chunk of vomit in her nose slid back down her throat. She closed her eyes. Don't close your eyes. She saw her hand in the puddle of vomit, close to her face. She could smell it, taste it. She watched her fingers move through the thick blue lumps. She was going to stand. She knew how to stand. She could feel everything now. Every nerve in her body was alive and on fire. Oh, the pain. She couldn't let the pain stop her. She had to move. She needed to get out of here. He was going to come back. He had promised that he would come back. He had begged her to wait for him. Move, move, move. She tried to push herself up, knees on the ground. A girl push-up. She could do this. Her head was pounding. Her heart rolled like a wheel. Her eyelids fluttered. She was so tired. She heard footsteps. Move, damn it! Move! She saw shoes. Black Nikes. Black swoops. Black pants. He was going to rape her. He was going to rape her. Again. She squeezed her eyes closed. Don't drink it. Spit it up. Run. She heard the punch of his knees hitting the ground as he knelt down beside her. His fingers pressed open her eyelids. He was making her look at him. She had tried so hard not to see his face, to be able to honestly tell him that she had no idea what he looked like, that she wouldn't tell the police, that she could not identify him, that he could trust her, because she would never tell, and now he was making her, forcing her to look at his face. She felt her eyes roll wildly, like a rabid dog, as she looked at the ground, the vomit, the trees, anything but his face. Gina Vogel? The man said. Her eyes moved of their own accord. He was younger than she had thought. He was wearing a black baseball cap. She saw the word above the brim. Bright white letters stitched against the black. Police.
What?
She croaked. Her throat was too sore. From the cold, from the stuff he was making her drink, from the vomit, from him.
You're gonna be okay, the police told her. I'm gonna stay with you until the ambulance comes.
He wrapped a blanket around her body. She couldn't sit up.
She was so dizzy. Light kept flashing in her eyes. So many lights. Her brain was like that turny thing inside of a police light, swirling and swirling, occasionally catching reality, then just as quickly letting it slip away.
"The man who did this to you is dead," police told her. "He will never hurt another woman again."
Gina's fist went to her lips. She tried to hold on to his words, to not let them slip away. She had survived this. She was alive. She would go home. She would make changes. She would become a healthier eater. She would work out 3 days a week. She would call her mother more often. She would be kind to her sulky, sullen niece. She would tell her 12-year-old boss that she actually did know how to sync her Outlook calendar. Police rubbed her arm.
"Just try to breathe through it, okay? You've been drugged."
"No shit, sir. That is abundantly clear."
"They're almost here," police said. "Go on and cry if you need to. I'm not going to leave you."
Gina realized she had shoved her fist into her mouth. She looked at her fingers like a mindless baby. Pointer, middle, ring, pinky, thumb. She could move them all. She closed her eyes. She could still feel them moving. She didn't even have to think about it. A laugh fluttered out of her mouth. Holy shit, she was so stoned. How could she be this high when she had literally thrown up her stomach? It was lying on the ground like a smurf shit. She waved her fingers again, trying to catch the soap bubbles floating like amoeba through the air. The colors were glorious. Gina was glorious. She was a gemstone tumbling inside a kaleidoscope. A warm, fluffy sock, lazily dancing around other warm, fuzzy socks in a clothes dryer.
"Ma'am," police said. "Ma'am."
God damn it, she was still old. 1 week later. Chapter 30. Sarah stared out her office window. The sun was setting. The parking lot at GBI headquarters was nearly empty. She could see Will's car parked beside Faith's Mini. Sarah's car was at home. Will had insisted on driving her the last few days. Amanda's Acura was several spaces closer to the front entrance. She turned back to her laptop. She had paused the video from Brock's office. The only part she cared about was the last 16 seconds. Sarah studied Brock's face. She wanted to see madness there. Danger, aggression. But it was just his face. He had asked her to take care of his mother. Myrna Brock had been found lying dead in her room at the assisted living home. Her hair and makeup had been done. An empty syringe was on her bedside table. The residue inside was dirty brown. Analysis showed that she had been injected with what was called a hot shot, heroin mixed with a lethal substance. In this case, embalming fluid. The same chemicals had been found in the syringe that Brock had injected into his own arm. He had designated Sarah as the executor of his estate. He'd left exact instructions on how his mother's remains were to be handled. He'd prepaid for everything, a common practice in the industry. Sarah had ensured that Myrna had been given a proper Christian burial in the Hartsdale Memory Gardens. Her own mother had attended the graveside, but the rest of the town had stayed away. As for Brock's remains, nothing had been specified in any of his documents. He had left it to Sarah to dispose of his body. She imagined that he'd assumed Sarah would be kind. She had paid for his cremation out of her own pocket. She had stood over the toilet in the funeral home and kept flushing until every last bit of his ashes were gone. Sarah pressed the space bar to start the video. Brock said,
"I didn't really give those women a choice."
She closed her eyes. But she had watched the scene so many times
that she could still see the wisp of a smile on his face. Brock had been in control from the moment Sarah had walked into his office. She had watched him roll up his sleeves. He'd prepared the hot shot ahead of time. He'd concealed it inside the edge of one of the binders. He had made sure that his mother would never hear about his crimes. He had dangled Gina Vogel's life over Sarah's head. Unlike his victims, he had gone out on his own terms. On the video, Brock said,
"I always did like a fire road."
Sarah opened her eyes. This was the part that always got her. The only indication that Brock was injecting himself was an almost imperceptible twitch in his shoulders. She heard her own gasp on the recording. He was pushing down the plunger. She stopped the video. Gina Vogel, still salvageable. Sarah's hand curled into a fist. The familiar admonishments rolled like breaking news at the bottom of a television. This hand had been gripping a loaded revolver. This hand could have grabbed the syringe away. This hand could have slapped Dan Brock across the face, beaten him, pummeled him, instead of remaining safely tucked inside of her pocket. Sarah did not know what to do with her anger. There was a part of her that longed to see Brock in shackles, shuffling across the courtroom, head hanging down, his brutality exposed to the world. Then there was a part of her who had been on the other side of that courtroom, a victim watching her rapist, her eyes swollen from crying, throat raw from crying, taking the stand, weakly raising her arm to point at the man who had taken away her sense of self. Could Tommy Humphrey do that? Could she walk across a packed courtroom and take the stand? With a chance to confront Brock, help heal her soul? Sarah would never have the opportunity to ask her. Tommy had blocked Sarah's number. Delilah had closed her email account. Callie's anger had not been granted the same invisibility. Faith had told her in person. The woman had a right to know. It wasn't their secret to keep. None of the victims or their families would have ownership of their secrets for long. The news organizations were already suing for details under Georgia's sunshine laws. They wanted access to the green binders. Dan Brock had left 6 inches of pages, meticulously recording his crimes against both the dead and the living. His stalking diaries went back to high school. He had raped for the first time while attending mortuary college. Tommy Humphrey had been his first mutilation. Rebecca Catarino, his first paralysis. Leslie Truong, his first murder. His notations included the victim's hair color, eye color, physical build, and information on their personalities. His collection of stolen hair accessories had been described down to the exact location they'd been found. Brock had brought his coroner's talents to the crime scenes, describing wounds and gashes, detailing the locations, the degradations, the return visits, the waning effects of the rehypnol, the points at which he'd decided to permanently paralyze them, the approximate times of death, the slicing tool he'd used to draw blood so the animals would take care of any trace evidence. Murder, rape, assault, stalking, forcible sodomy, mutilation of a corpse, necrophilia. Dan Brock had built nearly 100 cases against himself. And then, he had made sure that he would never have to answer for any of them.
Help!
Faith knocked on the door jamb as she came into the office. She held out her phone to Sarah.
Is this Ebola?
Sarah looked at the photograph of the rash on Emma's belly. Have you changed your laundry detergent recently?
I'm sure her cheap-ass father has.
Faith slumped down in a chair.
We finished looking at all of the security footage from Callie Zanger's building.
Brock went into her apartment 3 months before she was attacked, just like he outlined in his stalking journal. Sarah knew they would spend the next few months verifying the details from Brock's binders. Only a fool would take him at his word. What about the man in the black beanie from Leslie Truong's crime scene video?
Nothing. It's VHS. All they could get was a blob.
Sarah looked back at the paused video. Brock's thumb rested on the plunger of the hypodermic needle. She wanted to leave him like that, forever frozen in the process of taking the easy way out. Faith said,
I'm telling you this is your friend. You need to stop watching that video.
Sarah closed her laptop. I should have done something.
Take out the part where you saved Gina Vogel's life by going into that office in the first place, Faith said. If you had reached for that needle, Brock could have injected you instead. Or hit you. Or something bad, Sarah. Because he was nice to you for some reason, but he was a psychopath who murdered and mutilated women.
Sarah clutched her hands in her lap. Will had told her the same thing. Repeatedly.
I'm so angry that he had agency. He got to end it on his terms. Dead is dead, Faith said. Take the win.
None of this was a win. Everyone had lost. Except for Lena Adams. Nothing they had found would contradict Lena's testimony, detailing how the child porn was found on Nesbitt's laptop. Yet again, she had managed to walk away unscathed. Only this time, she was walking away with a baby in her arms. Sarah didn't need another thing to be outraged about. She changed the subject, asking Faith, how is Gina Vogel doing?
Maybe okay. She said something about moving to Beijing, then she said she could never leave Atlanta.
Faith shrugged.
One minute she's crying, the next minute she's laughing, then it's back to crying again. I think she's going to get through this, but what do I know?
Sarah didn't know either. She had somehow found her way back. She didn't know how or why. Some people just got lucky.
Daryl Nesbitt's in the hospital. His leg is septic.
Faith didn't seem bothered by the man's condition.
The doctors are saying it's not looking good. They're going to have to take more of his leg.
Sarah knew that this would be the beginning of the end for Daryl Nesbitt. The intellectual part of her wanted to rail against the unusually cruel system. But the baser part of her nature was glad that Daryl would be gone. Losing Jeffrey had taught her that sometimes justice needed a nudge. She asked Faith,
what about Nesbitt's offer to trade intel on the illegal phones being smuggled into the prison? Now that he knows he's not getting the pedophile charge off his sheet, he doesn't give a shit about the phones.
Con's got a con, Sarah said, anticipating Faith's views on the matter.
At least Gerald Catarino got something out of it.
She shrugged.
He won't let us test Heath's DNA against Brock's. But last I heard, the kid's been enrolled in elementary school. That's something, right?
It's something. Sarah wondered if Catarino was trying to maintain plausible deniability. One day, Heath would ask about the circumstances of his birth. It was easier to lie if you never looked for the truth. She told Faith, I heard Miranda Newbury copped a plea.
She'll be out in 8 months.
Faith sounded bitterly disappointed. Gerald Catarino was not Miranda's only victim. She had built dozens of grieving parents and spouses out of tens of thousands of dollars. Sarah said,
she did some solid detective work. Almost every name on that spreadsheet checked out. If she wanted to be a detective, she should have gone to the police academy or gotten her PI license.
Faith had paid her dues. She had very little tolerance for people who didn't.
You know what they say? When you do clownery, the clown comes back to bite.
Jane Austen.
Monique.
Faith pushed herself out of the chair.
I'm out of here, friend. Please stop looking at that video.
Sarah forced a smile onto her lips until Faith was gone. She opened her laptop. She played the video again. Brock laid the white ribbon across the green binders. Sarah had no idea why she so clearly remembered losing the hair tie. The fight with Tessa had been one of many. Sarah's hair had always been long. Over the years, she had lost hundreds of ties and bands. She'd had no idea that Brock had stolen this particular ribbon. And she had been so certain when she walked into Brock's office inside the all-care warehouse that he would not hurt her. Now she wondered. Her cell phone chimed. Will had sent a car emoji. She texted back a running woman and a man behind a desk, letting him know that she would meet him in his office. Sarah stuck her laptop into her briefcase. The brown paper bag inside the outer pocket crumpled. She had to take out everything and readjust it. She found her purse on the couch. She checked to make sure she had her keys and locked her office door. She dialed Tessa's phone number as she walked down the stairs. Tessa answered,
"What's up, swim fan?"
Sarah indulged her with a laugh. Her little sister was never going to let her forget the night Sarah had spent chasing Will around town like a crazy person.
"I was thinking about something." "Don't hurt yourself."
Sarah rolled her eyes. She pushed open the door to the morgue.
"When I got hurt in Atlanta, I went back home. And then when I got hurt at home, I went back to Atlanta."
Tessa gave a dramatic sigh.
"I've forgotten how to extrapolate. You were hurt, and now you're home, and I need to support you." "Took you long enough." "Thank you for your graciousness."
Sarah turned off the lights in the hall.
"I called around and got a couple of recommendations for some really good midwives. They're always looking for apprentices. I'll email you the details when I get home."
Tessa's huffing sound signified she would not be that easily placated.
"How are things with Will?"
Sarah glanced behind her. She could see the tiny office in the back of the morgue, where she'd rubbed lotion into Will's skin.
"You were right. I fixed it with a hand job." "Well done," Tessa said. "I'm still mad at you."
Sarah looked at her phone. Tessa had hung up on her again. She channeled her inner potty mouth as she walked toward the main building. She loved her little sister, but she was such a little sister. Sarah climbed another set of stairs. Because her life at the GBI was a never-ending stack of Legos, she shifted her briefcase, adjusted her purse. She felt a passing nervousness at the thought of seeing Will. He had been so patient with her since Brock's suicide. Sarah's tossing and turning was keeping him awake at night. He wouldn't let her sleep on the couch. Will had spent his childhood dealing with trauma. He knew that sometimes all you could do was listen. The hallway was dark when Sarah opened the door. Amanda and Faith had already left for the day. Only Will's office light cut a white triangle across the hall carpet. Sarah could hear Bruce Springsteen playing on his computer. "I'm on fire." Sarah reached back and pulled out the tie so that her hair fell around her shoulders. She waited for Will to notice her in his doorway. He smiled.
"Hey."
"Hi."
Sarah sat on the love seat in the corner. She let her briefcase and purse fall to the floor. She patted the cushion next to her.
"Come here. I've got something to show you."
He gave her a curious look, but he sat beside her. Sarah took in a calming breath. She had silently rehearsed this moment for days, but now that the time was actually here, she had butterflies. Will asked,
"Is something wrong?"
"No, my love."
She pulled the brown paper bag out of her briefcase. She opened the top and placed it on the couch between them. Will laughed. He recognized the McDonald's logo. He leaned over, peering into the bag.
"That's a Big Mac."
Sarah waited. He took the box out of the bag. His smile faltered.
"Something is in here, but it's not the weight of a Big Mac."
"Later, we are going to discuss how you know the weight of a Big Mac."
"Okay,"
he said.
"But did you throw it away in the regular trash or the dead people trash?"
"Babe, let the hamburger go."
He still looked disappointed, but she thought that would change soon. Will flicked open the box. He looked down at the blue Tiffany ring cushion Sarah had placed on a bed of black tissue paper.
The titanium and platinum wedding band was dark on the outside, light on the inside. Will never wore jewelry. His wedding band from his first marriage had been purchased from a pawn shop by Will. Angie had never given him anything. He stared at the ring, but he didn't speak. Sarah went through a series of silent rapprochements because the band was probably too thick, or he didn't like the color, or he changed his mind. She had to ask him, "Did you change your mind?" He carefully placed the box on the couch between them. He said,
"I've been thinking a lot about my job. Not the money, which isn't much, but how I do my actual job."
She pressed together her lips.
"What I do is I try to put myself in the bad guy's shoes. That's how I figure them out."
She could feel her throat tightening. He was completely ignoring the ring. Will said,
"I can imagine murderers and thieves and wife beaters and rapists. I can even understand Brock in a certain way. I'm really good at imagining a lot of things. But I cannot imagine what I would do if you died."
Sarah felt tears sting her eyes. The thought of losing Will was as unbearable as the thought of Will having to go through the hell she had endured when Jeffrey died. He said,
"I saw you on that Grant County tape from 8 years ago, and I didn't recognize you."
She wiped her eyes. 8 years felt like a lifetime ago.
"In the children's home, the way we got through it was, whatever bad thing happened to you, you just told yourself that it happened to someone else, that you weren't that person. You split yourself off, and the new person was the one who could keep going."
Sarah kept her mouth closed. He so rarely talked about his childhood that she didn't want to give him a reason to stop. Will looked down at the wedding band. She had spent too much money. He didn't like the color. The metal was too heavy. He said,
"You know my mother was a prostitute."
He was trying to talk her out of it. "Baby, you know that doesn't matter to me." His face was still turned toward the ring.
"When I got her belongings, she had all this cheap costume jewelry."
Sarah bit her tongue. The ring had not been cheap.
"Necklaces and bracelets and what do you call that ugly thing Amanda wears on her jackets?"
"A brooch."
"A brooch,"
he said.
"The necklaces were so old that the strings disintegrated. All of the silver bracelets had turned black. There were at least 20 of them. I guess she stacked them all together. What are those silver bracelets called?"
"Bangles."
"Bangles."
He finally looked up from the ring. He rested his hand along the back of the couch. His fingers played with the ends of her hair.
"What's the kind of necklace that's tight like a dog collar?"
"A choker," she said. "Do you want me to pull up some photos on my laptop?" He gently tugged at her hair. She realized he was teasing her. He said,
"You're so beautiful."
Her heart skipped. There was a dreaminess to his smile. Sarah had been swept off her feet before, but Will was the only man she had ever met who could make her weak in the knees. He said,
"Your eyes are such a specific color of green, almost like they're not real."
Will stroked her hair behind her ear. She tried not to purr like a cat.
"When I met you, I kept thinking I'd seen that color somewhere before. It drove me crazy trying to remember where."
His hand fell away, resting on the back of the couch again.
"I've been looking at rings for months. Princess cuts and marquee and cushion. And then I went through this whole panic where I thought I had to spend $80,000.
"Will,
You don't?
He reached into his pocket. He pulled out a small silver ring. It was cheap costume jewelry. The metal was dented. The green stone was scratched down the side. The color was almost identical to her eyes. He said,
"This was my mother's."
Sarah's hands had gone to her mouth. He had kept the ring in his pocket. He had been waiting for the right time. He asked,
"So?"
"Yes, my love. I would be delighted to marry you."
Sarah didn't need to hear the question. She was not going to screw it up this time. That was The Silent Wife by Karen Slaughter. Read by Laurence Bouvard. Produced at ID Audio. With post-production by Adam Gibbard and by Lucy Rushton. Text copyright, Karen Slaughter, 2020. Production copyright, 2020, by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Karen Slaughter asserts the moral right to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.